And let me make it clear right from the start, this is a study of the psychology of the characters involved more than the genealogies, the types, and lineages, except those closely connected with the main characters. Those things, of course, may come up in the discussion, although I'll suggest some subjects for discussion. There is no restriction to talking about the subjects or the incidents that I recommend. So, Ruth is the story of an ordinary human being who are not at all aware of the extraordinary parts they will play in even more extraordinary situations. Now, we as a group or as individuals unknowingly have some part to play in the Almighty's unfolding plan. The only other book in the Bible with a name after a woman is, of course, Esther. And it's interesting that these women had no intention of playing any part of note in the purpose of God. Esther had no intention or aspiration. In fact, she didn't want to do as Mordecai requested her to do. And neither did Ruth. She had no idea what lay ahead of her in her future. And in both cases, these women were manipulated. They went against their personal inclinations. In the case of Esther, it was Mordecai who manipulated her. And in the case of Ruth, then it was Naomi. So, about 350 years before the Moabitess Ruth came onto the scene, the Israelites had their first encounter with the Moabites. It's recorded in the book of Numbers. Some 40 years before that, an estimated 600,000 male Israelites left Egypt, headed for the Promised Land. And it seems that the reputation of the Israelites went before them because after they came out of Egypt and headed for the Promised Land, they simply rolled over any nation that opposed them. The land of Moab, then, was to be their last call before they reached their goal of the Promised Land. Now, you may remember that the Moabite king Balak, or Balak, heard of 500,000 ruthless Israelites heading his way, and he was sensibly terrified and sought help from the best prophet money can buy, Balaam. Now, Balak tried to bribe Balaam to curse Israel. And when that didn't work, Balak tried to bribe Balaam to do at least not bless Israel. But of course, the inevitable happened, and the Israelites' herds rolled into Moab. Now, only two of the adults, that is, over the age of 13, males who left Egypt, survived the 40-year trip, and they were Joshua and Caleb. And if we think about that for a minute, that means that there was an average of about 40 funerals a day performed over 40 years. And that only accounts for the males. So those who arrived in the Promised Land would be younger than 53. And that was probably why Balaam's advice to Balak was not to try to fight Israel, but to use the Moabitish women to seduce the young Israelites. Not surprisingly, the plan worked perfectly. The Israelite young men lusted after the bodies of the Moabite women more than they lusted after the blood of the Moabite males. And to add to their sins, they even started to worship Moabite gods. And for that transgression, 24,000 young men were executed by their jealous god, Yahweh. For his evil influence over the lusty young Israelites, Balaam came to an appropriately grisly end, and Balaam was a perfect mental replica of Judas Iscariot, who had been granted by the Almighty a privileged position, but chose to sell his talents to the gods of lust, avarice, and greed. So we'll see now, as we go on to the book of Ruth, the Moabites still had a role to play in the plan and purpose of God. Notice, first of all, the title of the book of Ruth. And that could be a bit of a misnomer, because Naomi is far more influential than Ruth in the natural scheme of things. And there's a lot more to this book than a love story. Although Sister Barbara Bookern wrote a short essay called Ruth, A Love Story. And I'm sure that any Bible student with an ounce of romance in their soul would find the book of Ruth worthwhile just from that point of view. Certainly, if there was ever any justification for saying that God works in mysterious ways his wonders to perform, the book of Ruth would be it. Now, as with any Bible accounts, there is far more importance attached to this book by some than by others. Interpretations differ as well. Some Jewish and some Christian Bible history students regard it, along with the book of Esther, as pure fiction. But as with everything else, other than the oneness and the omnipotence of the Creator and the first five books of the Bible, Jewish historians, rabbis, archaeologists, and commentators often find themselves at odds with each other. And since the Jews have not yet been forced to accept the Christ as the Messiah, the genealogy linking Ruth's significance to Jews to Christ does not have any significance with the Jews, whereas we Christadelphians accept it as being of great significance. Now, there's much in the book of Ruth about which we can't be dogmatic, and other things may cause raised eyebrows, but that doesn't mean that these things should be ignored or discounted. So I trust you'll find this study worthwhile as a refresher, even if you learn nothing new. Winston Churchill said he believed that being reminded of something is often as important as learning something new. So the first thing about which we cannot be dogmatic are the precise dates or the identity or identities of the recorders. Some say it was Samuel. Some say it must have been a woman. But most agree the final version of we have it is it has to be a combination or a compilation of efforts, noting that the final verses as we have them, linking Ruth to David, must have been added later than the main body of work, since David came so many years later than Ruth. Now, chapter 1, verse 1, tells us all this happened in the time of the judges, and perhaps that's all we need to know. In fact, strictly speaking, since we believe this is a part of the godly inspired scriptures, I suppose we don't need to know anything more than the basic text. And as with all holy scripture, our faith can be upbuilt when we dig deeper than the surface text. The period of the judges spread over a period of about 450 years, if we accept that they came into history shortly after the death of Joshua. And those who are authorities on the subject suggest Ruth lived between the times of Gideon and Samson, which would be a period of about 80 years. So generally speaking, it was a time when all but the most devoted worshippers of the one true and living God did as the Bible says, whatever was right in their own mind. Judges 17, verse 6 tell us that, and Judges 21, verse 25 agree. Perhaps in passing, I should point out that we shouldn't compare judges as recorded in Scripture with the kind of judges we have today. They weren't part of an established legal system where they would acquit or punish individuals. They were generally individuals who were raised up to serve God in a specific way for a specific time, and most of the time they only enjoyed prominence for a brief season. And I may only be speaking for a brief season unless I get a drink of water, so here it is, thank you. So, Deborah is the exception. She was the exception in more ways than one. She was the only woman judge ever chosen by God, and must have been some woman, because she was totally devoted to the Almighty, unfailing in courage, and perhaps, God willing, the subject of one of my future Bible classes. So, when we're introduced to Elimelech and Naomi in chapter 1 of Ruth, they were living in Bethlehem, Judah, as we've just read. It was in the time of the judges, as we've seen, and there was famine in the land. So everyone was doing what was right in their own mind. And Elimelech, being one such person, decided to move his wife Naomi and their two sons, Mahlon and Chilion, to the land of Moab, where there was food. Now, when we read even the first couple of verses, surely they prompt a few questions in our mind. First of all, how could it be that only 50 miles away, 80 kilometers for the under 40s, there was lots of food to be had, and yet in Bethlehem, Judah, there was a famine, and for what some historians estimate was for at least 10 years. Now, famine was not unknown, of course, in Israel, and in times of famine, Egypt was the usual breadbasket for Israelites. But if Elimelech had chosen to take his family to Egypt, it would have been a much longer and more hazardous journey if, as they passed through Philistine territory, the natives became restless. The most likely reason for this localized and protracted famine was not a natural occurrence caused by adverse weather conditions. It was more likely that it was brought on by the Philistine marauders constantly robbing Israel of their crops. You see, if Israel went to war and obeyed the law of Moses, they were under constraints as to how they were to treat their enemies, and particularly their crops and fruit trees. The Philistines were under no such constraints. They did whatever they needed to do to win and to profit by winning. Now, we know from Scripture that when Israel went astray from God's laws, punishment would not be far behind. The Philistines were often the instrument God used to inflict that punishment on Israel. Elimelech and Naomi lived in Bethlehem, and the name means house of bread. But since that name was no longer appropriate, but there was plenty of food about a couple of weeks' journey away, Elimelech decided to up stakes and go for it. Now, that move would be made regardless of his knowing they were moving to an enemy country and a cruelly idolatrous nation. The name Elimelech is said to mean, "My God is king." But he's certainly not acting that way at that point, is he? So some scholars believe, instead, that his name was not Elimelech, but Elimolech, meaning, "My God is Molech." And Molech was the main god worshipped by the Moabites. It suggested that Elimelech was the name given to him by his Moabitish or Ammonitish mother, who had married an Israelite. If that is the case, it's easy to see why he would choose to head for Moab. I say he decided to go to Moab, because although Naomi may well have agreed with his decision in those days, it wouldn't have made the slightest bit of difference if she'd not agreed, because the man of the house would decide whether they go or not. Now you notice in the text, Naomi is his wife and the boys are his sons. Even so, they deliberately chose to live among pagans rather than bear Yahweh's punishment for a season. So Naomi, whether so inclined or not, went along taking their two sons, Mahlon and Chilion. In that patriarchal society, although Naomi wouldn't have had much choice, once there, she seemed to have settled in quite comfortably, thank you, for at least 10 years and possibly longer. It's Naomi's decisions that decide the direction of the story and of Ruth's life, except for one major decision. Ruth chapter 1 verse 4 isn't explicit whether their total stay was 10 years in Moab or that they stayed 10 years after the boys were married. I suspect it was the latter because there's no indication that the boys were adults when they first moved there. Now a slight digression and perhaps something to prompt comments later. Bible names always fascinate me. Usually, they relate to characteristics or circumstances of persons involved. Adam, for example, was named by his creator, and it means of the soil or earthy, and Eve means life-giving. Abram means father of height or one of lofty position. His name was changed by God to Abraham, meaning father of a multitude. The name Jacob means supplanter, because he took his brother Esau's birthright by trickery. And Jacob subsequently had his name changed by God's command to Israel, meaning ruling with God. Now, all those names given by the Almighty are appropriate and make perfect sense. But there are others that aren't given by God and don't make sense. And it's hard to imagine any parent ever giving their child such a name. You remember Abigail, that woman of great beauty and intelligence who entranced David and became one of his many wives? Her name means source of delight, and I'm sure David would say amen to that. But whatever would have possessed a woman of her quality, beauty, and intelligence to marry a loser like Nabal, whose name means fool? It just doesn't make sense. I mean, picture this. A young couple have a new baby, and they're delighted because it's a boy. And it's very important that they have a boy to carry on the name and become heir to their real estate property. They look down at the little cherub, and Mama says to Papa, "Darling, what shall we name him?" And Papa thinks for a minute and says, "Sweetheart, I think he looks just like your father. Let's call him Fool." I mean, it doesn't make sense, does it? That would, prompt a lot of trouble in the family. Well, can you imagine Elimelech and Naomi naming one son sickly and the other wasting away? That's what the names Mahlon and Chilion mean. Again, it doesn't make sense. I believe the boys were originally named the equivalent of our Tom, Dick, or Harry, and wasting away and sickly became their names as it became obvious that they were appropriate. So, I'm suggesting that the names were changed by the recorder of the story, so as to create them in a situation that fit the story. And the same with Nabal the Fool. I believe they were all wished upon them by others as they became appropriate. Most of us, I'm sure, have witnessed or experienced at some point in our life being branded with a nickname. And as we know, nicknames are not always kindly chosen. And as we may already know, Naomi asked people not to call her Naomi, meaning sweet, any longer when she got back to Israel, but to call her Mara, which means bitter. And she blamed God for her destitute situation. Well, however they got their names, the family of four arrived in Moab, under 50 miles from Bethlehem in distance, but a world away from Bethlehem in religion, culture, and morals. And that's not surprising, because the land of Moab was so called after the man Moab was born as a result of incest between the drunken Lot and the elder of his two daughters. Desperate for a son and living in complete isolation in a cave, after having been rescued from burning Sodom by angels, she and her sister, each in turn, tricked their father while he was drunk into siring a son. The son of the younger sister was Ben-Ammi, the founder of the Ammonites. And there was no love lost between Israel, the Ammonites, and the Moabites. They were at each other's throats constantly. But at that particular time, there was no problem between them, and there was nothing to discourage Elimelech and Naomi from migrating to Moab. Again, though, remember, some historians suggest Elimelech was a Moabite or Ammonite name, so he may have been accepted as one of their own and to their society. Or, as is the case even today, the borders between some countries are so very porous and not clearly defined, so they may have just drifted over the border and remained in more or less anonymity. For all the depravity of the Moabites, and despite Israelites having been forbidden to intermarry or even to intimately associate with them, many Israelites found Moabite spouses and the Moabite way of life, even their gods, appealing. Makes us think of that saying, forbidden fruit is always the sweetest. In fact, by the time the wisest man who ever lived, King Solomon, came on the scene, intermarriage was still very common. Solomon himself set a bad example by having pagan wives and concubines among his 600. He even went so far as to build shrines for them to worship their gods. I suppose then it's not surprising that many of his subjects, who were not as devoted to Yahweh as they should have been, would have thought if Moabite wives are good enough for Solomon, then Moabite spouses are good enough for me. But the practice continued long after Solomon. But it seems that King Solomon, for all his wisdom in ruling Israel, was very unwise, even debauched, in his personal life. And he later got his comeuppance from the Almighty. The boy King Josiah made the first real effort to stem the tide of mixed marriages. But it took a focused effort by Ezra and Nehemiah to slow the practice down, as they not only banned mixed marriages, but dissolved existing mixed marriages. Now, there are many aspects to the book of Ruth that force us to make decisions, even if that decision is that we're not going to decide. One conundrum is what we choose to believe was the motivation behind the decision to go to Moab when they did. We could decide that Elimelech made a wise move by taking his family to well-fed Moab instead of having them suffer famine in Israel. It appears that even if he wasn't exactly wealthy, he was certainly a landowner and quite comfortably off. Naomi and the family enjoyed a far above average lifestyle. So why didn't Elimelech simply buy provisions in Moab and bring them or have them brought to him in Bethlehem? In moving to Moab, the family apparently sacrificed land, social position, and their association with those of like precious faith. But did they make the move because pining and wasting were already obviously in a downward spiral and would almost certainly have died at a much earlier age in Israel? We must never forget that progeny was always a major preoccupation with Elimelech and Naomi, as it was and still is for people of most cultures where land legacies are getting involved. And the way prices are going here, it might be that way here before very long. So they would have been obsessed with making sure that they gave every opportunity to wasting and pining to produce at least one male child to carry on the family name and be able to lay claim to the family real estate in Israel. So we could say all praise to the wisdom of Elimelech for migrating. However, the other side of the argument goes like this. Sure, there was famine in Israel, but its cause was not cyclical or natural. It was one created by the Almighty, either by allowing the Philistines to rob Israel of the bulk of their crops, or by the Almighty's manipulating local climatic conditions in order to create a local famine. The Bible records other occasions where God did that. In either case, it was the Almighty's way of punishing Israel for deserting his ways in order to do what was right in their own eyes. And by migrating to a totally perverse and pagan land, Elimelech tried to get beyond the reach of God's hand. It's obvious the famine was not so severe that scores of people were dying in the streets, because there's no record of a mass exodus to either Moab or the traditional breadbasket, Egypt. The short-term gain for food that Elimelech and his family enjoyed was followed by long-term pain. When the Almighty has our punishment in mind, we might as well face it. It will happen. Where can we hide or whither fly, Lord, to escape thy piercing eye? While they were in Moab, there were no Yahweh-fearing women for pining and wasting to marry, but the urge for progeny grew stronger each day. That caused this erring family to take another two steps on the slippery slope toward apostasy. The sons took pagan wives for themselves. Mahlon married Ruth, a Moabite princess, and Chilion married Orpah, in spite of their parents, if not the boys, being fully aware out of Deuteronomy 7 verses 1 to 6, expressly forbidding such marriages. So, if things were bad for the family in Israel, things went from bad to worse for them in Moab. Elimelech died, leaving Naomi in the unenviable state of widowhood. Meanwhile, pining and wasting would be striving to produce male heirs, but neither one was up to the task. And even if they had been, it wouldn't have made a particle of difference, because the Bible tells us the Lord had closed the wombs of Ruth and Orpah to prevent either of them bearing children of bad seed. You see, if God had allowed either woman to produce a male heir, his plan involving the chosen one, Ruth, would have been frustrated. Ruth was totally unaware that in due course, when the time was right in God's eyes, she would be called out of Moab, that land of debauchery and idol worship, just as Abram was called out of his land. So it appears that within 10 years of Elimelech's death, Finding and Wasting breathed their last as well. And as we might imagine, Naomi was beside herself with grief, misery, and fear of the future. There she was, no husband, no sons or grandsons, a poverty-stricken widow, far from her own kith and kin. Well, which interpretation do you accept? Or is there yet another? You may want to comment on this later. So, one thing about which there can be no dispute is that Naomi and the loving and lovable Ruth and Orpah clearly loved their mother-in-law, Naomi, as much as anyone could. They had a love for each other that the Jews describe as hesed type of love, which according to the Hebrew definition is the kind of love that goes far beyond duty. It's a love of the kind that goes beyond earning. And that reflects our position before the Almighty, doesn't it? We cannot earn the kind of love that God has for us. Nevertheless, Naomi was a deeply flawed character. But then who isn't? Naomi hears the famine is over in Israel, and we may infer from that that Israel had repented and God had relented. Naomi decides in her penury to go back to her birthplace, no doubt preferring to be penniless among her own than in Moab, where she would be much worse off. Because under the law of Moses, an Israelite woman, widow rather, would be eligible for certain social benefits, whereas as a non-citizen of Moab, she would be strictly on her own. So Naomi told Ruth and Orpah of her plan, and is quite taken aback, it appears, when Ruth and Orpah both declare their intention to go with Naomi to Israel. Naomi probably had no wish to return to Israel with two Moabites, and when questioned, as she certainly would have been, have to shamefacedly admit that they were her widowed daughters-in-law. Even though wives of strange flesh were not so rare in Israel, they were still a black mark on the reputation of the families involved. So Naomi had enough to worry about without having to face that kind of hassle when she gets back to Israel. Much better for her to return home as a forlorn, penniless, repentant widow, having lost her husband and two sons. That role would evoke much compassion, but that compassion was likely to quickly evaporate with the appearance of a couple of Moabite daughters-in-law. Naomi used every argument she knows to persuade Ruth and Orpah to stay in Moab. Go and marry and have children, she said. I'm too old to have sons, she said. They wouldn't be yours to marry anyway, because you would be too old for them. She tells them at least four times to stay in Moab. Orpah family finally gave in to Naomi, but not Ruth. Ruth's affection for Naomi was so strong, she insisted on going with her. As she speaks one of the most memorable vows of the story in chapter 1, verse 16, whither thou goest, I will go, thy people shall be my people, and thy God shall be my God. Now, some Jewish commentators believe Ruth's affection for Naomi was the only reason Ruth made that vow, and her conversion to becoming a worshiper of Yahweh had not then started. Orthodox Jewry to this day read the whole book of Ruth at Shavuot It commemorates the day when God gave Israel the Torah, which contains the first five books of Moses. Why the book of Ruth is read is not perfectly clear, but one idea that is widely accepted is that Ruth was repulsed by the Moabite worship of the idol Molech or Moloch. And that's not hard to believe when we consider Moloch was a massive all brass or bronze figure having the form of a human body on the head of an ox. He sat on a throne with his arms on his knees and palms upturned to receive sacrifices. However, his abdomen was a furnace, and when his arms glowed red, a girl child was placed on them to die a horrible death, her screams drowned out by drums rolling, cymbals crashing, horns being blown, and people shouting their praises of Moloch. So it's hardly surprising that Ruth, longing for a child of her own, would be horrified by such rituals. No surprise either, she would be attracted to the loving, caring, yet disciplinarian Yahweh, the Almighty, living God of Israel, whom Naomi would probably have at least mentioned from time to time. Presumably, Ruth could have chosen to adopt to Naomi's religion, stayed in Moab, and had the best of both worlds, assuming, of course, she had not been disowned by her wealthy family for marrying an Israelite. But Ruth probably recognized that in spite of being surrounded by idol-worshipping hordes, Naomi's values remained rooted to a great extent in those of the Israelites, and Ruth didn't want to lose that association. There's an old Jewish proverb that says a single coal separated from the fire will soon die out. And how much more applicable could that have been to Ruth, left alone in a Moabite society? And that proverb is well, we do well to keep in mind. It can be applicable today to any Christadelphians finding themselves in isolation or in those forsaking the opportunity of assembling themselves together, either in person or by Zoom. Great devoutness is required to overcome isolation, and great test of faith it is. Ruth determined to go with Naomi, despite Naomi's repeated discouragement. 12 times Naomi stated or implied Ruth should stay in Moab. Neither Naomi nor Ruth had the slightest inkling of the major part Ruth was to play in Ruth's becoming part of the genealogy of Christ. How could she? There were no angelic visits or visions. Naomi was living by her wits. She was still doing what was right in her own eyes. There's no record of her even pleading with the Almighty for guidance. And one rabbi points out that he sees as Ruth's extraordinary response to Naomi's discouragement. He writes, neither woman had any legal or moral responsibility to the other. But in her famous declaration, which we've already mentioned, Ruth signals her intention to change her identity in a world where that was almost inconceivable. The rabbi goes on to say, the ancient world had no mechanism for religious conversion or change of citizenship. The very notion was unthinkable. Religion and peoplehood defined one's ethnic identity, and this could no more be changed than the color of one's skin. A Moabite was always a Moabite, wherever he or she lived. And indeed, Ruth is defined throughout the story as the Moabitess. But from Ruth's point of view, she is becoming an Israelite. She's not only joining herself to Naomi on the private level, but on the national peoplehood level. And the rabbi goes on to say, the amazing thing is that although lineage is defined through the males, it is the women who bear the responsibility for the continuity of the family and the guardianship of the lineage. It is the women, often despite their husbands, who ensure the birth of the next generation and who direct the proper line of inheritance. Sarah, at first barren, provides a surrogate mother, Hagar, for Abraham. And later, when she bears her own son, Isaac, she sees to it that he, and not Ishmael, is the designated heir. End quote. Little is known of Orpah. Probably she died unconverted. Rumor has it that she was rejected by her Moabite family and society and became a woman of easy virtue. But that's likely to be a fabrication or morality tale, illustrating how important it is to make the right choices in life. Orpah is only mentioned in the Book of Ruth. Much of the general information about Ruth comes from Jewish history. It says that Ruth was a Moabite princess and that even after marrying Mahlon, she was used to a high standard of living. Apparently, Elimelech's family enjoyed the good life too, up to the time of his death. So, we're getting close now to the time when we should be closing the class. I won't go any farther in this session. Hopefully, in the future, I'll be able to finish the study. So, how many would like to come up here and say something? Don't all rush. Just one?
I can't do.
Oh, two? Okay. Two from the same tree? Okay, so we have 7 minutes, so you've got 3.5 minutes each. Okay. Age before beauty.
Thank you, Jack, for your comment tonight. And I know you're one that really chooses your words carefully, so I'm kind of curious, maybe afterwards if I save it, if I speak a little 30 seconds less, you can come back and answer the question. You use the term manipulated in terms of Esther and Ruth. I'd be curious as to your conclusion around manipulation. To me implies that there was some trickery and some nefarious reason and rationale. So I'd be curious about my sense is, you know, I've been listening to a talk recently on Samson, and he's a much maligned individual, and yet he shows up in Hebrews 11 as one of the faithful ones. I've been challenging myself lately to challenge myself and not to read into the text in ways that like in terms of you use the term not to be dogmatic. So I'm curious. If we look into the text, I think for me the text of Ruth, because I did read it, I took your offer last week and read through Ruth again with some tried to do fresh eyes, which is hard to do. And some of all those questions that you have raised were ones that I had in my mind as well. So such as, was it a good reason that Elimelech took his family into the land? And then when I step back, I go, well, we're not actually told good or bad. It just says it happened. These things got married. And so I think the story for us is more about the events that culminated in Ruth coming into the truth through that process. So it's interesting always for us, I think, to consider, weaving into the story some of these things. But I think, you know, if we step back and we realize that we're not actually told certain things, then I think sometimes it's important for us to just, it's interesting to pursue a line of reasoning, but I guess in the case of Ruth, I think the conversation was primarily around what I saw is a young lady that somehow in the relationship in the area in which they grew up, there was a love for God, Yahweh, despite them being out of the land, that somehow Heather clung to her mother-in-law and wanted to be part of that hope and part of that faith. So I think that's definitely a part that comes out of the story for me. So anyways, I just wanted to sort of add in that, but I'm curious if you had anything specific. I mean, you may or may not have to answer that around that specific term, because I know you were careful with your words. So
yeah, that, while you're here. Well, I hope to answer those questions in the next session, God willing. In the meantime, as I said at the start, I'm looking at the psychology of the people involved. We know what the end result was, and we know how Ruth came into the lineage of Christ, as did Rahab. But we're human beings, and so were they. And they operate on the basis of human reasoning, and despite all that, they still work out in the plan and purpose of God. But we should never think for one moment that they didn't have the free will. They had the free will to do whatever they wanted, as has been already illustrated, I think, and they weren't forced into any situation by God. And as far as the manipulation is concerned, Mordecai was the one who pressured Esther into doing what he thought she should do. And if you remember, she resisted. And then the same with Ruth and Naomi. Naomi was thinking, what's best for me? And she didn't want Ruth to go back with her. And yet, it happened that she did, because it was in the plan and purpose of God. But they weren't predestined, is what I'm saying.
Thanks, Brother Jack. Just a quick comment. Hopefully it makes some kind of sense. I've been doing a study on Ruth as well recently and was working on it at the personal Bible study weekend. And I was looking at verse 1 and the word sojourn. I'm kind of just building off Jack's point, talking about sojourning to Moab. It's an interesting word. It comes from the root word to turn aside from the way. And so when we read the word sojourn, we need to look at the context, because turn aside from the way, it could be a positive thing or it could be a negative thing. And so the first time that this word is used is back in Genesis chapter 11, I believe it is. Genesis 11 or 12. Genesis 12 with Abram when he decides to sojourn into the land of Egypt. And then ultimately we know what happens there with his wife. And so that was a negative thing. But then ultimately, later on, Abraham would be a sojourner again, in a positive light, going to a land that God would show him. And it's kind of an interesting process that we can go through with that word. And so always look at the context when we read the word sojourn, and that will kind of help us out with, whether it's going to be a positive thing or whether it's going to be a negative thing. Here they're sojourning away from Bethlehem. And we know that's where eventually the Lord Jesus Christ would be born. And then just the process, just the last comment, just the process here. In verse 1, we see sojourn, and then we have entered, and then we have remained. And that's kind of the process of sin as well, I guess, is sojourning away from the way. And then we enter, and then we can remain. And that's kind of as well like Lot. We think about Lot when he chooses to the greener pastures. He pitches his tents, so he sees Sodom and Gomorrah from a distance, and then he enters and then remains there. So yeah, just a brief comment.
Thanks. Yeah, thank you both, and hopefully there's enough interest that when we finish the story, there'll be more comments as well. And anyone has anything to say after the class, then I'd be happy to hear it. Positive or negative.